You are tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM, listener-sponsored radio in Western Canada. And coming up right now, here it comes, Animal Voices. It's now just after 12. It's 1 minute after 12, and it's time for the Animal Voices show. We are all lined up and ready to go. The animals are cavorting around the control room, and we're trying to get them under control so our hosts can move into their microphones and take over. So who's on first?
Okay, I'll tell you about my guest, who's going to be calling in very shortly. Her name is Maria Sirosky. And she is an animal activist in the city of Vancouver, a person who has been working with needy cats for 15 years. She has a method that she's going to tell us about. And I think it's a very appropriate time to be talking about needy cats, because just yesterday I was going through my internet items, and I found that in Toronto they're having a major problem with kittens, because the population has grown considerably in recent years, and many people believe this is a result of the milder winters. Cats are more outdoors for a longer time. They have a greater opportunity to breed, and they are breeding earlier in the year, getting impregnated about February now, and having kittens in March or April, so that now they're able to have three litters a year, whereas formerly it was normally two. So that adds a lot to the burden of the Toronto Humane Society. They have placed 6,000 kittens in 2006, whereas in 2002 they had just about half of that, about 3,000 kittens. So that this is really a major problem, and people like Maria, who is our guest, or going to be our guest, are trying to make things better for these poor little creatures who are left out in the cold and suffer greatly. It's one of the biggest problems, I think, that we have in the animal welfare world. I know that when I was in Saskatoon about 4 years ago, we were working with the SPCA on that very issue. I'm wondering if Maria has noticed any improvements in that. I'm a cat lover myself, so that I've almost always had at least one cat in my home, and they are such delightful creatures. It's just terrible to think that so many of them are being abused on the street. So that maybe we could have just a bit of music, and I think Maria will be calling in just any moment.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let me just say what I'm going to be talking about, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Because there seems to be a little confusion as to who is the host here. There's only two of us here today, besides Alan Jensen, and it's Marge Adams and myself, John Pranger, and Carl Loskin isn't here today, and neither is Alart. So I'm going to tell you, we're going to be playing the audio portion of a video put out by Europeans for Medical Progress, and there's overwhelming evidence that animal experiments provide results that, when applied to humans, can prove misleading or fatal. You know, one of the biggest drug disasters in history now has been the Vioxx scandal, with something like 60,000 heart attacks, or 120,000 to 60,000 deaths, some incalculable number virtually. It's just shocking that this drug was launched onto the market on the sole basis of a few very small clinical tests, but mostly on monkeys and mice and so on, and found to be very good for the heart. In fact, it caused heart attacks in human beings, so you see the vile nature of this whole enterprise. So we're going to be letting you hear the audio portion of an expert discussion, or a discussion by experts, on the pitfalls of animal experimentation, and it's called Safer Medicine. So we'll be doing that around the halfway mark.
And Maria is on the line now.
Oh, hello, Maria. Are you there? Can you hear me?
I sure can.
Wonderful. It's wonderful to have you back on the show. It's been a long, long time since we've spoken. Now, I know you're working, you've set up a new group, as a matter of fact, haven't you? Thistle Street Cat Rescue.
Yes.
You are a dedicated person, Maria.
Well, we're just getting up and running. It's going to be a trap, neuter, release.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
For the street cats in Vancouver.
Good.
And that's, you know, neutering them, spaying them, tattoo, vaccinations, and these are street cats.
Yes.
The tame cats, of course, we'll bring into different rescues. For instance, Vancouver Orphan Kitten Rescue or other shelters, or try to get them adopted. But the feral cats, which are the cats that were born outside and are not socialized with humans, are returned to their locations if people are willing to feed them.
It's a very difficult job, and time-consuming, isn't it, to trap a cat, a feral cat, I suppose, especially.
And there's not enough people to help me trap them. That's the problem, and there's so many.
Yes,
so many.
I'm sure. Now, tell us about trapping, because I think a lot of people don't know what it involves.
All right. Well, people will call and say that usually they found kittens in their backyard. And along with the kittens will be a mother, of course. And cats like to live in colonies where there's food, so there's usually other strays there also. And if they're not spayed and neutered, of course, I spay and neuter them. I set out a humane trap. It has food in the back, and they just walk in, and the door closes behind them. If it's a mummy with the kittens, I send them to Vancouver Orphan Kitten Rescue, where she can raise her kittens, and then they'll spay her after. If she's feral, she'll go back. If she's not, she'll be adopted. And once I trap an adult cat, for instance, I take it to the vet, and it gets spayed and neutered. I keep it for 3 or 4 days to heal and then return it.
Now, this trapping is more than just putting out a trap, though, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's time-consuming, but, you know, if I have volunteers to help me, it's a lot better to watch the traps, ferry them back and forth to the vet.
You have to,
but it's every day. I'm out every single day.
And you have to monitor those traps.
Yes.
Or someone else has to.
That's so true.
Do you sometimes get neighbors who are willing to do that, perhaps?
If they're willing, yes, absolutely. And if not, I have to stay there.
Just stay there?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? Sit in your car?
I do. Make my phone calls. Get my other locations lined up.
Uh-huh. And does it go on 24 hours a day? How does it...
Oh, from the time I get up till late at night.
Uh-huh.
Come home and drop into bed.
Is there a better time for trapping than
usually evenings. The feral cats come out when it's dark because they're so scared, you know?
Now, so you trap them, then you have them neutered, and it's costly.
It's very costly. It's $50 per cat. And so far, like, I don't have the money to do this, so I've been depending on two organizations. Kensington Foundation for Animals has given us about $3,000, Citizens Pets about $2,000, and Vancouver Orphan Kitten Rescue has been paying a lot of mine because there's just not enough money, about $15,000, and it's about, I would say, $30,000 a year to fix the amount of ferals that I do. But mind you, there's many more out there.
Yeah, but if the amount you, the number of cats that you do, 30,000, do you manage to get all that financial aid?
Well, I wish there was more money for it. You know, it's donations that help these organizations pay for this. Last year, I spayed and neutered 300 cats, put them back, or else if they couldn't go back, I found barns and stables. And if anyone knows any horse stables for me, please write in. And I took 150 mummies and 800 kittens to the Vancouver Orphan Kitten Rescue. All those cats are off the streets.
Wow, that's a big contribution to city life for the citizens, I would say, as well as for the cats.
Yeah.
And they live in colonies, you say?
They do. They try to find a food source. And they're social animals, as opposite of what some people think, that they're independent. They're social animals. They live in families.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and they get along well in colonies. I mean, they don't fight a lot.
They do, and a lot of these feral cats will accept tame strays into their colonies also. Cats end up on the streets usually for two reasons. Either they're lost, there's somebody's cat who is an indoor-outdoor cat and has gotten lost, doesn't have identification on it as in a tattoo or a collar or tag. And so when I find these cats and they're tame, there's no way for me to find the owner. So that's really important that people have identification on their cats. If they're spayed and neutered, they'll have a tattoo in the ear.
Oh, yes.
Which I can trace, but sometimes people don't keep their address and phone number up to date. And that's another thing, I can't trace the owners.
Ah, yes.
So they're either lost, and most of them that I find that are tame strays are not fixed, and people are not spaying and neutering their cats. If a person is low income and can't afford to, the SPCA hospital here in Vancouver will do it for them for free. So I'd like your listeners to please spread that news around. So that's one thing we can do there. And the other reason they end up on the streets is they are abandoned. People move and leave them behind. Our city, you know, is really hard to find accommodation for pets. And people will leave them behind. And, of course, then they have babies on the streets, in back alleys, under sheds. And then those kittens are not socialized with humans. And they are so-called feral cats.
Oh, yes. Now, there are shelters, aren't there? A lot of kind, usually ladies, have over the past, and I'm sure still are, setting up shelters for cats. But of course, they're limited in numbers.
Oh, yes. Richmond Homeless Cats has 800 cats for adoption. Forgotten Felines in Surrey has 300. Meow Aid has 100 here in Vancouver, but they're now closing. So, you know, things are really tight. The shelters are full right now. So many people are surrendering their cats for different reasons. They're moving, allergies, new baby, that sort of thing. There's just way too many cats and not enough homes.
Right.
And that's the problem. People need to spay and neuter.
That's been almost a lifetime effort, hasn't it, for many, many people who work in this field.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's really sad.
It's very frustrating. We don't have cat bylaws in Vancouver or Burnaby. The other municipalities around us, Delta, Surrey, North Van, do. And those bylaws help people like myself reduce the cat population, because there's three bylaws. One, you have to have identification on your pet. So if they get lost, they can be found, such as in a tattoo. Secondly, there's a spay and neuter bylaw that any cat over 5 or 6 months needs to be spayed. And three, breeder's license. So if you're going to have your cat have kittens, you have to have a breeder's license. Now, this is going to stop all these people who are making pocket money by breeding their cats and selling them for $100.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Imagine with all the strays on the street and people, why are these special breeds, perhaps?
Nope, just regular old cats. You can go to Craigslist or other internet buy and sell, and you'll see the same phone number in there all the time. It's the same people.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, they're not licensed, I don't suppose, are they?
Well, there's no bylaw.
No bylaw
at
all.
So they can do whatever they want. So I encourage all your listeners to write into the Vancouver, perhaps, council. It's mayorandcouncil@vancouver.ca, and ask that there be bylaws in place for cats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and these, I guess, ordinarily are municipal, and provinces have such laws, I guess.
No, it's not provincial. It's each city makes bylaws.
Yeah, which is the hard way for an organization who is working to get passed, isn't it?
Cat rescues can complain all we want, but unless they hear from the public that there's a problem, they won't make bylaws.
Right. Now, have you noticed any improvement over all these years? Have you been at it at least 15, probably more, in quiet ways? Have you seen anything that causes you to be optimistic?
Oh, I'm rather disappointed. The number of cats being surrendered to shelters is rising. It's really high in the summer. Mm-hmm. People just are treating these cats as if they're toys. You know, they're a little bit of trouble, and then they want to find a home for them. And so many cats are getting lost. You see all those posters all over.
Yes, I know.
And they don't have identification on them. I think the problem is increasing. I'm hoping I'm making a dent in the feral populations by doing the spay and neutering, but it's just really me full-time doing it. Hopefully, if we start our Thistle Street Cat Rescue up, we can start raising money ourselves for spaying and neutering these cats.
Yes, and get registered.
Get registered.
I think that's
right.
Important. I think it encourages people to donate.
Right now, we're just depending on the Vancouver Orphan Kitten Rescue. We're taking anyone who finds stray cats or knows of ferals. They can write into orphankittenrescue.com. and tell us where the cats are, and I can get my butt out there and try to fix them.
Well, good for you.
Yeah.
Do you sometimes feel a little overburdened?
Oh, I mean, it's just my life. I have no life anymore. It's just every day doing this, and I'm so tired. I need help. I'd love your listeners to come down on Monday to Granville Island, BC Day there.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be in front of the Kids Market along with the Vancouver Orphan Kitten Rescue. And I'd love people to come down and meet me, meet the kittens and the adult cats that I have taken off the streets. And we'd like to find foster homes for them and also to adopt them.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, tell me, what do you expect of a foster home?
Foster homes, with these little kittens and their moms, if they're tame, you know, and the tame strays, all we require is just a temporary home for them. We give them the litter, the food, any medical care is paid for. All they have to do is just look after them until they're adopted. So it's short-term. And then we have some adults that could be longer term if somebody wanted the companion of a cat for 5-6 months. You know, we're willing to do that and give them all the food and litter, and they don't have to pay for a thing or commit to a cat for its lifetime.
Ah, yes. Now, and if a person wants to adopt a cat, are there certain demands you make of them as well?
Well, the Kitten Rescue does want indoor homes for these cats. And the reason is they've been born on the street, and some of them have been strays, and they've had a miserable life on the street, not having food, hungry, alone. They just want to be in a nice warm bed and not have the chance of being lost again.
Oh, yes, and so much work goes into the rescuing, and then to have them back on the street again would be just too much, wouldn't
That's
it?
That's right.
Now, I think John has a question.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's probably a redundant question because I wanted to know their role in rodent control. I mean, there must be lots to eat for them. And you say they live miserable lives, lonely and deprived. So, I guess my question is really not.
Well, that's a very interesting question because a lot of the feral cats will eat rodents when there's not a food supply, but tame cats that have been lost or abandoned have been depending on their owners for food, and they just don't know how to find the rodents and such, and they end up just sitting in a corner starving themselves. And I find them just almost half dead.
I guess that's because most of the mice live indoors. Now, what about the rats, which are going to become a problem very soon if this strike isn't over soon?
Yeah.
I see them out around the, of all places, the provincial and city courts, you know, the police building. You know, they're scurrying around. They're very small rats. I imagine a cat could attack one and kill it.
I'm sure they could. You know, that's their natural instinct is to go after a little moving object. And with the garbage strike, I'm sure there'll be a lot more food for them. But also these cats, you know, if they've been born on the streets, they have never been vaccinated. They're prone to all sorts of colds, distemper. They can get abscesses from fights. It's horrible, some of the cats I pick up with huge infected abscesses. And they're just about dying when I pick them up. And they need a lot of veterinary care, and it's very expensive.
Sure.
I'm not sure I believe very much in vaccination, but...
Yeah, well, you know, I don't either. I'm a big fan of Cornell University, who says one vaccine lasts 3 to 5 years. But the street cats do need the one vaccine. And that's all they'll get when they're returned. They'll probably never get another vaccine.
What is that?
It's just a distemper and upper respiratory vaccine, not the rabies.
Because I've read veterinarians who say that the distemper vaccination have caused an epidemic.
Over-vaccination, absolutely. Every single year of vaccinations is not good.
Oh, no, and yet we were told to do that for a long time, weren't we?
Cornell University, if people Google that, will find some wonderful information on vaccines.
How hip are doctors in this city to that?
Some of them. Some of them are starting to read the research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, if somebody wanted to volunteer or to adopt a cat, perhaps, could you give us a number?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They can go to orphankittenrescue.com, mm-hmm. and the phone number is, I believe it's 731-2913.
2913.
Which is a message machine.
Okay. Orphankitten.com.
Orphankittenrescue. All one word,
.com.
And did you say you vaccinate the kittens, or you don't?
The kitten rescue gives them one vaccine.
Okay.
Yeah, good.
And $100 for a kitten on the black market. Is it sort of a black market?
Well, yeah. These kittens that are in the newspapers and such, they don't come with a spay or neuter certificate, and they're not... they don't have a free vet check. And
well, how does that compare with a kitten from the SPCA or the...
SPCA usually has a certificate also,
mm-hmm.
very
it's,
much
it's
like
a bit
the kitten
more money
rescue that for the spaying and neutering at 5 months. And they need to be fixed at 5 months. Otherwise, they'll go into heat and have babies. Mm-hmm. And the SPCA, I believe, has a free vet check also.
But how much will a kitten cost you from the SPCA?
I'm not sure. I think it's around just over 100.
Oh, yeah. So there's no savings there.
No.
To go to the black market, and you get a better,
mm-hmm.
Well looked after cat, and it's history a little bit.
Yeah, and free kittens too. You're going to have to pay their spay and neuter and their vaccines and that sort of thing. So it's not free.
No, so people would still have to have their cat fixed.
That's right.
Buy it for $100 from puppy mill. You call them, or
kitten mill.
Kitten mill. Sorry, yeah.
Backyard breeders, we call them.
Right.
And also,
but there's no reason to have your cat have kittens. There's so many that need homes.
Right.
There's not enough homes for them all. And people will say, I can find my kittens' homes. Mm-hmm. But what about those 900 at Richmond Homeless Cats? Or, the 200 right now at Vancouver Orphan Kitten Rescue? It's just a cycle of overpopulation of cats.
Yes, and I'm sorry to hear that Meow Aid is closing down.
I know.
That was, a very good shelter.
Many, many years of hard work.
Absolutely.
It's ongoing. It's not getting better.
I guess it's burnout. People can only take so much, can't
they?
That's
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I certainly admire what you're doing, Maria.
Well, these poor street cats, though, they've got it the worst because they don't have shelter and they don't have people feeding them. So... we have to spay and neuter them. We have to find people to feed them if they're feral and get all the tame ones off the streets and get those kittens off the streets so they don't reproduce.
Right. And, you've got years of work ahead in all probability, but keep your spirits up.
I hope one day we'll see a difference.
Is there any country in the world that doesn't have the problem?
Everywhere does.
Everywhere.
Yeah,
yes,
sure.
Even Regina, like you said, Toronto is bad. Wherever there's high
country.
Density and not enough apartments that will take animals, it's tough.
I think we're going to have to wind it up there, Maria.
Okay,
it's been wonderful talking with you. Thank you for being on the show.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. You have been listening to an interview with Maria Sirowski, who is a cat rescuer, and is setting up the Thistle Street Cat Rescue, a new group just very recently. And she has a telephone number, which she gave us, for the Orphan Kitten Rescue. And if you're interested in getting involved in this, and I hope some are, it's 604-731-2913. Thank you.
And bless her soul. Thank you. There's a new booklet proclaiming the benefits of primate research, and it makes insupportable claims. These claims are made by a professor, Colin Blakemore, who is infamous in the world of the anti-vivisection movement, in that he sews the eyelids of kittens shut in order to study something called blind or lame eye in human beings. Well, this man contends that, you know, a man like that is really blind to suffering, his studying blindness is really an irony, that he claims that experimenting on primates is vital for researching Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, strokes, and other diseases, and that the ban on using great apes should be relaxed in the future if necessary. And, of course, he'll say what's necessary when it's necessary. But there are a number of errors and contradictions in his claims which reveal his position to be insupportable from any perspective. Because if there's no current need now to use the great apes, as he himself states, there can't be any future need. And the United States government concluded that chimps are deficient for use in AIDS research and redirected $10 million of funding, and other primates are similarly deficient. There have been 80 AIDS vaccines, 50 preventive, 30 therapeutic, and they've all failed in human trials following success in primates. The maddening thing about it is that the great animal protector, Peter Singer, who wrote the book Animal Rights, is in favor of this, of lifting this ban, if he says this should become necessary. In other words, he believes in the usefulness of animal experimentation, and none of the animals are going to get out of the cages if he has anything to do with it. So let's play the European for Medical Progress film called Better Medicines, and we'll hear a discussion by experts on the need for reform in this field. So here we go. We got a bit of a technical thing here. I hope it all works out. Here we go.
Medicines to treat pain, infection, allergies, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, and many other problems. But although these medicines benefit many of us, others suffer side effects which can be worse than the disease itself. Ironically, side effects of these drugs designed to help us are now one of our leading causes of death. There is an urgent need to improve current methods of assessing drug safety, both during human trials and before the drugs ever reach the human testing phase. Currently, the linchpin of these preclinical methods consists of a series of tests on animals. These are required by the government for the purpose of protecting volunteers in clinical trials, which are the real acid test for all new drugs. Animal testing is usually considered controversial because of the suffering of the animals involved. But many scientists believe that its consequences for human health are equally controversial and deserve more attention. Europeans for Medical Progress Trust is a charity whose goal is to improve human health and protect patients by ensuring that all medical research is relevant to humans. Their scientists have studied the available evidence to see whether testing drugs on animals is a reliable way to make sure our medicines are safe. Dr. Jared Bailey is a research associate at the University of Newcastle upon Tyne and consultant to Europeans for Medical Progress Trust.
For the past 40 years since the UK Medicines Act of 1968, the government has insisted that all new medicines should be tested on two species of animals, one rodent such as mice or rats, and one non-rodent such as dogs or monkeys, before they're tested in people for the first time in clinical trials. The Medicines Act was brought in as a response to a terrible tragedy that had been unfolding over the previous 10 years, and which was then the biggest drug disaster the world had ever witnessed. The name of the drug was thalidomide, and from 1957 to 1961, it was given to pregnant women in many countries to treat them for morning sickness. It was heavily promoted as a wonder drug and said to be completely safe, because in many tests in a wide variety of animals, it had caused no ill effects, even at huge doses. But in humans, it wasn't safe, particularly in pregnant women. It caused over 10,000 babies to be born with short arms or legs, or with no arms or legs at all.
After more and more children started to be born like me, thalidomide was tested on many different species of animals, almost none of which suffered the side effects shown in humans. Eventually, researchers discovered that New Zealand white rabbits also gave birth to malformed offspring, but only when enormous doses of the drug were used. The bottom line is this. More animal testing would not have prevented the release of thalidomide, because the scientists would not have found the side effects. Even if New Zealand white rabbits had been tested, thalidomide would still have come to market, because a vast majority of the species showed no ill effect from the drug. It amazes me that some people claim that more animal tests would have averted the disaster. The highly respected Office of Health Economics concluded that it is unlikely that specific testing in pregnant animals would have given the necessary warning. The right species would probably never have been used. Furthermore, Dr. John Shardine, an expert in birth defects, commented that in over 50 strains and species in which thalidomide has been tested, including even armadillos, birth defects have only been induced occasionally. So basically, if scientists were seeking to approve thalidomide as a new drug today, the weight of evidence from animal tests would indicate that it should be safe to be used in humans. The thalidomide tragedy happened over 40 years ago. But what have we learned since then? Has science moved on? Can we be sure that a similar tragedy won't happen again? I think that there should be tests to identify such dangerous drugs and chemicals. But which tests are up to the job?
I recently reviewed the success of tests that have been carried out for over 40 years since thalidomide to predict the potential of drugs and chemicals to cause birth defects in people. The results show that these tests, using animals as diverse as rats, dogs, cows, and monkeys, agree with results in humans only around half of the time. We might as well have flipped a coin. I also reviewed studies that used in vitro or test tube-based methods and found that these are significantly better at predicting the response in humans, with up to 80% accuracy. So we do have superior methods, but our regulations are stuck in the past. The crucial question is, can we be sure that there will never be another thalidomide? Well, let's look at what happened recently with the drug Vioxx. Vioxx is a painkiller that was prescribed mainly for arthritis between the year 2000 and 2004. It was tested in animals and found to be good for the heart, but it went on to cause over 300,000 heart attacks and strokes in people, nearly half of which were fatal. This is the biggest drug disaster in history, many times bigger than thalidomide. In fact, adverse drug reactions are now one of our leading causes of death, killing many thousands of people every year. We're not suggesting that animal tests are responsible for those side effects, but they did fail to pick them up in safety testing prior to those drugs being marketed. And in fact, over 90% of new drugs that pass successfully through animal tests go on to fail in human clinical trials in volunteers and patients. They're abandoned either because they're too toxic or because they don't work in people the way that they did work in animals. And in addition, we've undoubtedly lost good drugs because of animal tests, drugs that were abandoned because they harmed animals, but that could well have gone on to be safe and effective in people. Penicillin and aspirin, for example, wouldn't even reach clinical trials today. And the US National Cancer Institute admits that we have lost cures for cancer because they were ineffective in mice.
It's clear that there are serious problems with our current systems for making sure new medicines are safe and effective. For example, in March 2006, a clinical trial at London's Northwick Park Hospital made headlines around the world when six healthy young men were nearly killed by a new drug which was given to them after it had been shown to be safe in monkeys at 500 times the dose. The US Food and Drug Administration, the world's largest drug regulator, has complained that we're using 20th century tools to develop 21st century medicines. Fortunately, there are many new technologies and companies addressing this problem by focusing on the way that the human body responds to new drugs before actually testing them out on people in phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials.
Randall Charlton is the founder and chief executive of Astarand, the world's leading human tissue company.
What we do is we help the world's great drug companies discover new drugs, develop them, and get them into the clinic with more confidence. So how do we do that? Well, quite simply, we operate a network of hospitals around the world in about 15 countries, and we collect, under strict ethical conditions, tiny amounts of human tissue backed by large amounts of data, all properly anonymized to protect patient and donor identity. I think it's self-evident that mice are not men, and in order to develop drugs with more confidence, wherever possible, one should use the human model, the species in which the drug is eventually going to be given. I'm really proud of the fact that at Astarand we have a team of scientists who are helping to develop ways to cut the cost of early stage drug discovery, and at the same time reduce the reliance on old-fashioned models, the animal model, as it will, if you will. Perhaps I should introduce again my colleague Bob Coleman, who has had more experience than pretty much any other scientist I can think of in working with human tissue.
It's important to remember that the pharmaceutical industry is developing drugs for use in humans. And for that reason, a focus on human biology, I believe, is very important. Now, historically, the industry has relied very much on the use of animals, both isolated tissues and whole animals. But it's also had its problems. I've got many years' experience in the industry, and I worked for 30 years in a major pharmaceutical company where the use of animals, animal tissues, was the norm. And the thing that frustrated me there was the lack of predictivity of many of the data that we generated. And even at that time, I made as much use as I could of human tissue in trying to focus on what I thought was relevant. And it was because of this experience that a colleague and I originally founded Pharmagene. Now, Pharmagene has since become Astarand. But the idea of Pharmagene right from the start was to provide a resource to the industry of human expertise, human tissue expertise, so that we could, in those days, provide services, which we termed phase zero, to the industry. Since then, we have worked with virtually all of the major pharmaceutical companies and are currently working with, I think, the top 30 companies in the world to provide them with both tissue, on which they can conduct their own services, and the services themselves. There are many needs for improved medicine in the world today. There are diseases of the lung, of the bowel, of the cardiovascular system, of the brain, all of which need improved treatments. The industry is finding it increasingly difficult to get new drugs onto the market. The time taken is colossal. It takes something like 15 years to get a drug to market, and the cost is estimated to be of the order of $1.6 billion per drug. And even when they get onto the market, drugs aren't necessarily totally trouble-free. The role of Astarand is to provide high-quality tissues and high-quality services to enable the pharmaceutical industry to more effectively get safe and effective drugs to the market.
And if I can add an optimistic note here, Bob, the fact is that the drug industry is placing increasing reliance on the human model for early stage phase zero drug discovery. And there is going to be a need for Astarand to grow dramatically to meet the needs of the industry, as well as for other companies who offer similar human research services as we do.
An ingenious new technology that brings us closer to mimicking the whole human body in the safety of the laboratory is being pioneered by Hurel Corporation in California. Dr. Greg Baxter is the co-founder and chief scientific officer of Hurel.
Drug discovery is a very expensive and inefficient process. Hundreds of thousands of compounds are pursued for many years prior to finding a drug that is safe and effective. Clearly, there is a pressing need for better tools to accurately predict human response to potential therapeutics. Accurate prediction of human response is difficult, often unreliable, and invariably expensive. There is considerable concern whether animal studies can predict human risk precisely enough, and traditional cell culture assays do not accurately mimic the complex environment a drug encounters within the human body. To address these limitations, we have developed an interactive, cell-based, microfluidic biochip. The HURL, which is a condensation of the words human and relevant, is composed of a network of interconnected microfluidic compartments and channels, which replicate the organ and the blood system of the human body. Each compartment represents a different organ or tissue. For example, an early prototype chip was designed to investigate inhaled toxicants, such as naphthalene. In this example, there is a lung compartment as a target tissue for toxicity, a liver compartment, which is important for drug metabolism, a fat compartment, which is important for accumulating drugs and breakdown products, and an other tissues compartment, which replicates the holdup of circulating blood in other tissues of the body. The culture medium is a blood surrogate and recirculates in the HURL system, just as blood recirculates in the human body. The prototype biochips are roughly the size of a postage stamp and are fabricated in silicon using standard microfabrication techniques traditionally used in the microelectronics industry. But most importantly, the geometry of the chambers and channels are designed to mimic key aspects of the human body, such as the time taken for a drug to circulate and where it goes in the body. With the HURL system, drugs are exposed to a more realistic physiological environment, thus providing higher and more accurate informational content than traditional in vitro assays.
Another way of predicting what effects a drug may have in the human body is to find out which genes it affects and in what way. This can be done using DNA chips, small glass slides the size of a postage stamp containing thousands of tiny wells. Samples of DNA are placed in these wells, and a computer detects which genes are being activated or suppressed by the drug in question. A Cambridge company, Simugen, uses the latest cell and DNA-based methods combined with advanced computer programs to predict how toxic a drug will be. Their methods have been able to detect hazards to the human liver that were missed by animal tests. Dr. Quinn Wills is the co-founder and chief scientific officer of Simugen.
As a company, we've realized that predicting the toxicity of substances is really important, not just to big drug companies, but to the chemical industry and to people in the cosmetics industry. The question is, how does one predict the toxicity of a molecule before we put it into human beings? And we believe as a company, the only way to really get this right is to look under the hood of a cell. And by that, I mean have a look at what the genes are doing. So what we can do is allow you to culture chemicals with human cells, have a look at the genes, and then actually put that into models of how we think this translates into toxicity. Doing that, we can tell you what kind of toxicity we think is going to come up, at what dose do we think this toxicity is going to come, very important, and we can give you some feel for what you could be doing to your molecule or your drug or whatever it is you're creating to make it less toxic. What we do is use mathematical models of how the genes are actually changing to predict those dose-response relationships. So it's a very, very exciting technology because we're addressing several things. First of all, we're giving you this richness of information that current methods can't give you. We can predict toxicity, we can tell you the level at which it's going to be toxic, we can give you some indication of what you could be doing to make it less toxic, and we're doing it in a way that is very cheap, very fast. It takes 24 hours to do a cell culture. So this is something you can use right at the beginning of, for example, a drug development pipeline as a company, which will save an enormous amount of money and decrease the reliance on animal testing.
A further way of predicting what effects a new drug may have on the human body is by computer modeling. As we learn more about the human body and about how drugs work, this information is continuously fed into computer models of various organs, which can be manipulated in an astonishing variety of ways. Professor Dennis Noble of Oxford University was the first scientist to generate a computer-based model of beating heart cells in 1960. Although all of his early work was based on information gained from animal hearts, with his collaborators, he has now pioneered the development of models based on the human heart.
The image you're looking at may appear to be a film of a living human heart, but it isn't. It's a highly sophisticated computer program using tens of millions of separate equations, combining graphics and mathematics to create one of the first of a new generation of simulations called virtual organs. These are set to become some of the most powerful tools we have in the fight against disease. With scores of uses from disease diagnosis and drug design to training and research.
My involvement in modeling the heart and other organs began over 46 years ago when I was working in London. I was the first person to build a computer model of the activity of individual heart cells as they were beating. And that was based on experimental information that we obtained on the nature of the processes occurring in those cardiac cells. Now, those models were very simple, and they ran on very, very simple computers. Nowadays, 40-odd years later, we have masses of more information, thousands of laboratories all over the world accumulating experimental information. The models have become very much more sophisticated, and most importantly, they've been incorporated into models of the whole organ, so that you can actually see the organ itself beating away.
The virtual heart allows doctors to study the effects of a heart attack in controlled circumstances without endangering a real patient. And unlike real life, in which a heart attack can take just a few seconds, the progress of the attack in the virtual heart can be slowed down, speeded up, and repeated at will, enabling scientists to measure exactly what is happening.
It's worth emphasizing that this is a major international collaboration, not just scientists here in Oxford University, but also scientists elsewhere in the world have contributed to creating the virtual heart, particularly a team in Auckland, New Zealand, teams in the United States, teams in Japan, and teams elsewhere in Europe, teams in Korea and China. So it's a worldwide collaboration to build the models of the organs of the body. They've become sufficiently sophisticated that they are now used in pharmaceutical research and for assessment of drug action by regulatory agencies. 10 years ago, or nearly 10 years ago, I was involved in using one of these models to help a major pharmaceutical company, Roche, to process the drug application that they were making to the Food and Drug Administration in Washington at that time, and we successfully helped them to get their application through. And there have been other examples more recently where companies like Novartis have used the model to clarify the actions of the drugs that they are developing. So the work is already partially achieving the object of enabling some of the work that is normally done on animals to be done instead on computer simulations. But I should emphasize this is early days. We can't yet look to a time when you could replace animal experimentation entirely by computer simulation. But clearly, the long-term goal would be to achieve a situation where, just as in the aircraft industry, you don't build an aircraft before simulating it on a computer, in the future, people will not build new compounds, new drugs, new medical devices without simulating their actions on the various organs of the body.
Virtual organs such as this one allow researchers to develop and test new drugs faster, more confidently, and at less cost. Scientists are already busy creating other computer simulations which work with each other to show the whole human body as an integrated dynamic system.
One of the best ways of finding out how a new drug will behave in the human body is to give it to volunteers at a minute, safe dose. Then, by using incredibly sensitive measuring devices, scientists can monitor where the drug goes and how it is broken down in the human system. Microdosing is an exciting new breakthrough in drug testing. It uses machines so sensitive that they could detect a liter of liquid after it had been diluted in all the oceans of the world. Acceleron is the world's leading microdosing company, of which Professor Colin Garner is the founder and chief executive.
Acceleron is a spin-out company from the University of York. It was founded in 1997, and it has pioneered a technique based around a very ultra-sensitive piece of analytical equipment called accelerator mass spectrometry, or AMS. The sensitivity of this equipment has allowed us to do some very novel things in terms of developing drugs. In particular, the company has focused and pioneered an area of research called microdosing, in which trace doses of drugs are administered to human subjects in order to obtain essential metabolism information. Now, why is microdosing of interest? Well, it's of interest because it allows us to get human metabolism information much earlier, much more safely, and with minimal use of animals. Now, the great attraction of microdosing from a drug development point of view is that you can take your drugs into humans with much reduced costs and much reduced time compared to classical, traditional, so-called phase one methods. So typically, to take a molecule into man using classical phase one methods might cost as much as £3 to £5 million and take anywhere between 12 and 18 months. Whereas using the microdosing approach, we can do the same type of study at much less cost, typically around about £250,000, and get the results in 4 to 6 months. So there is a time and cost saving to the approach, and it's been estimated that by 2008, as many as 40% of pharmaceutical and biotechnology companies around the world will be using microdosing. 2010, nearly 90% of all companies have stated that they will be using microdosing routinely in their drug development programs.
These new technologies enable drugs to be developed and tested specifically for humans. Yet there is still a vocal strand of opinion which insists that new treatments will only come from research involving animals, and that it would be unethical to expose people to drugs without first showing that they are safe in animals. But this view is increasingly questioned by members of the medical profession. Cathy Archibald is the director of Europeans for Medical Progress Trust, who commissioned a survey of family doctors.
We hear so often that scientists and doctors are united in their support for animal testing, but we know from our involvement with the scientific and medical communities that that is simply not the case. Many doctors and scientists have significant doubts about the value of animal tests and recognise that animal research and medical research are not one and the same thing. We commissioned one of the world's largest market research companies to conduct a survey of 500 GPs across the UK. The survey found that 83% of GPs share our desire to see the medical value of animal tests evaluated scientifically. That's an extraordinary level of concern. I know from my own experience as a scientist working in drug development and as a patient with a serious illness that much animal research is simply irrelevant to human medicine. What happens in animals doesn't matter. It's what happens in people that counts. My disease was in the pancreas, which scientists have just discovered is so dramatically different between rodents and humans that studying mice and rats is futile. The object of study has to be human. We acknowledge that there's no such thing as a drug that will be absolutely safe for everybody, but we do believe that drugs could and should be safer than biops, for example. And we believe that one reason why clinical trials are risky is that very often, instead of information about safety in humans, all we have is an assurance of safety in animals, which, as the story of thalidomide should have taught us, means very little. The fact that 9 out of 10 drugs fail in clinical trials proves that point very clearly. So does the fact that prescription medicines are our fourth biggest killer after cancer, heart disease, and stroke. We believe that drug trial volunteers should be protected from risk by making sure before clinical trials that the new drug is as safe as possible, something that may well best be established by a battery of human-based tests, such as those we've just heard about. Today, animal tests are required by the government to license a new drug, while the sophisticated tests we've heard about in this film are not.
We have heard from the experts about the potential of the latest methods for assessing new drugs. But are the people responsible for legislating for drug safety listening?
Many politicians are concerned about animal experimentation, but believe there's a dilemma between protecting animal welfare and advancing medicine. Yet there is growing evidence that favouring the state-of-the-art methods we've seen in this film would benefit medical progress as well as laboratory animals. Tony Benn was a Member of Parliament for over 50 years and a Cabinet Minister for 15 of those. He's given the matter some serious consideration.
A lot of doctors and scientists are now challenging the scientific value of the use of animal testing for human purposes. And these arguments have to be taken seriously. 250 members of Parliament have signed a motion in the House of Commons calling for a government inquiry. And that call has the support of a lot of people from the medical profession and, of course, from the public as well. And what is really required is a proper scientific evaluation of the methods that are used to decide, or make it possible for us to decide, what is the value of animal testing. And it's never been done before, and there's nothing whatever to hide, so I can't see any case against it. This is not an argument against science. Quite the opposite. It's an argument for bringing modern scientific thinking to bear on an issue that has in the past been simply described as if it was those who were in favour of animal rights against scientists. It is actually a very important scientific development. And all that we want to see is the government to set up a review where these arguments can be properly evaluated in a scientific way, because quite apart from anything else, thousands of people suffer from the side effects of drugs, and some of those ill effects might be averted by using better methods. And the government should now, in my opinion, make this a priority, because if they did that, then this argument could be settled in the best possible way for the benefit of everybody concerned.
Europeans for Medical Progress Trust believes the government should commission an independent scientific comparison of the results from animal tests with those from a battery of human-based tests to see which more accurately predict the human response. Most MPs and GPs support this idea. The outcome couldn't be more important for those of us who await new drugs for ourselves or our loved ones, or for the volunteers who take part in clinical trials for the benefit of society and medical progress. There is clearly a need to ask whether consumers are really best protected by animal tests, or whether it is time to embrace the 21st century technologies that years of research have brought to fruition. Many of us have simply been unaware that such sophisticated methods are available and have been persuaded to believe that animal tests are the best or only method we have. We hope that this short film has offered a glimpse of the many new techniques that are paving the way to safer medicines for us all, thanks to their focus on human biology.
Okay, and that was Safer Medicines by Europeans for Medical Progress Trust. Now, what I'd really love for you to do is to download this program yourself from curedisease.net. That's www.curedisease.net, or Europeans for Medical Progress, and maybe send it along to your MP and demand something similar here in Canada. So thanks very much for listening. This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Animal Voices. We'll be back next week's Friday, 12 o'clock. Thanks for listening. Bye.